artificial intelligence will completely transform our world. But what is AI? Why will it affect you? And how can you and your business survive and thrive through the AI revolution? Welcome to AI and You. Here is your host, author, speaker, and futurist, Peter Scott.
Hi, this is episode 197, and today I will be talking with Eve Herold, author of the new book, Robots and the People Who Love Them, Holding On to Our Humanity in an Age of Social Robots. Eve is an award-winning science writer and consultant in the scientific and medical nonprofit space. She writes about issues at the crossroads of science and society, and has been featured in Vice, Medium, The Boston Globe, The Wall Street Journal, Prevention, The Kiplinger Report, and The Washington Post, and on MSNBC, NPR, and CNN. So when you hear about robots, people, and love, Hollywood has already paved a well-worn path for our minds to go down, and so I won't be surprised if that's where yours has already gone. Heaven knows we have enough material to work with. And that kind of interaction between people and robots will be in my conversation with Eve, but a minor part of it. A larger question is, how do we relate emotionally to machines, and why do we have these emotional connections? These are important questions at a time when the lifelikeness, if that's a real word, of robots is growing by leaps and bounds, and we're entering new territory with the ability of chatbots, which is another kind of robot that Eve discusses, to hold realistic and meaningful conversations with us. So let's get right into the interview. Well, Eve Herold, it is a pleasure to welcome you to AI and You, your book, Robots and the People Who Love Them. What robots do you love the most?
Well, I have to say my all-time favorite robot is a fictional robot, and that was the android Data on Star Trek Next Generation.
Cool, and major point.
If I are going to have a robot, I would like to have a Data. That would enhance my life a lot.
And as I recall, Data didn't even use contractions, and we've already advanced beyond that in our chatbots, which can emulate emotion. What about Data endears him to you?
You know, I think Data, even though he's presented as a being with no emotion, he still is a very good personality and a good person, so to speak, if I can use that word. He's kind. He's considerate. He thinks of other people. He's always looking to help. And he has a very charming personality. I don't know if that'll ever truly be carried over into robots, but it certainly can be simulated to an extent.
Well, and that's one of the really interesting questions that your book explores in depth, because robots may not be engineered to be charming, may not have any self-awareness of being charming, and yet we can often perceive them as charming, right?
It's very true. And, you know, I write about how we all like to think of ourselves as rational decision makers and people who are, you know, driven by reason. But our social and emotional hardwiring actually says something different about us. It says there are some predictable ways that our emotional and that we can be engaged socially and have our emotional buttons pushed. So we like to think we would be impervious to robots. I've actually interacted with a couple of them, and I was truly amazed at how easy it was to get just seduced into the illusion of a living being that you're actually connecting with. That I think, is part of the danger of social robots.
Indeed, your title is as much and probably more about people than it is about robots. And it's a study of how we react to robots, irrational humans. And Kate Darling, for instance, talks about a study done with this toy dinosaur robot where researchers asked other people to play with them for a while and then smash them with a hammer, and they refused. And these were highly educated researchers who knew exactly what robots were. Everyone knew that. And they refused point blank to do it. So that just shows how easily we ascribe some level of sentience to mechanical objects. What does that mean for us as human beings?
Well, it means that we are going to have new categories of relationships with beings that we haven't encountered before, and that we will have to learn how to understand. And we need to keep a very firm line, you know, and I think the danger is, and the research consistently shows this, that when we interact with robots, even if it's robotic animals, or even some pretty utilitarian-looking robots, the lines between living and unliving, the lines between how to categorize a personality are blurred in our minds. So we kind of think they're living, and we kind of think this is what our brain thinks. We may not rationally be thinking that, but that's the way our brain is lighting up. It's using those same parts of the brain to ascertain what's going on. And it's something that is kind of under the radar with us. It's kind of, to some extent, subliminal, which makes it even more seductive.
It seems that we are hell-bent on ascribing some kind of life to inanimate objects. This goes back to stories like the Velveteen Rabbit, and obviously much earlier. You describe something in the early 1900s, an incident I wasn't aware of. Oscar Kokoschka, who requested that a doll be made according to his specifications of, was it his, I forget, his wife or?
It was his ex-lover.
Yeah. And he was very particular about this. And I looked up a picture of that, and that is one of the creepiest things I have ever seen. It just makes my hair stand on end to even think about that. And yet, well, not that he is alone in this respect, especially in an age where people have married, in quotes, robots or bots of another form. And that again gets us into the psychology. What direction is this going in? I mean, granted, it's been going on for hundreds, thousands of years, if we look at Greek legends. Is it getting worse?
Well, it's getting easier for people who are either vulnerable or inclined to those kinds of erotic fantasies and relationships. There is a ready-made market for robot, love robots, I do believe. I based a lot of my understanding of it when I researched the book on the relationships between men and sex dolls. And those relationships, we look at them and kind of go, wow, you know, that's ridiculous. But those relationships are far more intricate and far more emotionally enmeshed just with simple love dolls than we can imagine, really, unless you were actually in that relationship and were vulnerable to that sort of thing. And now the robots are just getting way more realistic and way more able, and they're conversational, and they can give them a heartbeat, and they're warm to the touch, and that takes it to a whole different level. I don't know how that's going to end up, but I do have concern about human relationships and possibility that some humans could be displaced in their relationships in favor of a love robot, which is ever accommodating.
And while the state of the art in physically mimicking human beings is very primitive, the state of the art in reproducing the cognitive processes has grown by unprecedented factors in the last 18 months. And so now we're looking at chatbots that could give a very reasonable imitation of what we saw in the movie Her, where a man fell in love with the operating system of his phone, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, who we never see, doesn't have a body, doesn't have an appearance. We could do that now. We could do the voice with the emotions. We could do the conversation. We could do the emotive content of the conversation. And we could even slap an avatar on it with some video to go one better. And that was a very thoughtful movie about that relationship, which I think, talking about the love dolls, a lot of people would go, well, I don't relate to that. This is another world and I'm not part of that. And okay, fine, but that doesn't mean anything for the circles I inhabit. But when we look at what chatbots, and you include chatbots in your definition of robot, are capable of now, talk to us about some of the research and writing that you've done about where they are taking us and what we have seen.
Well, chatbots are unquestionably taking us to a greater level of digital enmeshment in our lives. And they're somewhat revolutionary because they are designed to appeal to the human emotional nature as well as intellectual nature. And some of them can be very good at mimicking concern, emotion. There are therapist chatbots, and this was before generative AI came around, so it's not quite as fluid as generative AI. It's programmed responses, but that are created by psychologists. And it gives people daily, basically check-in, mental health check-ins, and it practices a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. For people who need that kind of therapy and want to do it privately and have it in their own home, and have it relatively cheaply compared to seeing a therapist on a regular basis. And no therapist is going to follow up with you on a day-to-day basis. But anyway, it's been learned through research about people's interactions with these therapist chatbots in both the military and in the civilian sector. And it turns out that people are way more uninhibited about what they will tell a robot therapist than what they will tell a human therapist. One of the psychologists I interviewed for this told me that the reason why is because there's a lot of noise in human relationships. And that noise is the fear of rejection, anxiety, the fear of inadequacy, that sort of thing. Those programs that we all tend to have in our heads, that's a lot of noise. And being with a robot that's incapable of judging you removes the noise immediately. And you have at least this sense that this is incredibly private and protected information. I don't know that it totally is because programs can be hacked, but people see it as very private and it tends to loosen them up. I mean, it's very popular. There's a robot called Woebot, W-O-E-B-O-T. And it's very popular and some corporations are now covering it for employees, making it a benefit for employees. Some insurance covers it, not all. So I think there's a real future in that sort of thing. And it can have a positive, beneficial effect on a person's life. I don't know if it's going to call an ER or an emergency services if you tell the robot, for example, I'm really agitated today. I feel like I'm going to have a breakdown and maybe get a gun and shoot up a school or something. I don't know that you're going to get connected to the kind of services that you would need for an intervention in a situation like that. So I think that's one of the downsides of this online service. But within the realm of what it does very well.
Right. And defining what that realm is rather interesting and tricky. I mentioned Woebot in my last TEDx talk and drew a line to that from Joseph Weizenbaum's Eliza, when his secretary asked him to leave the room so she could have a private conversation with this chatbot that was 17 pages of source code at the time, and then was annoyed later on to find out that he got logs of all the conversations. And you mentioned the question of what if someone requires a physical intervention. As a coach, I know that I have a responsibility, and therapists have an even more onerous responsibility, that if someone causes you to think that they may do themselves or others harm, you have to notify someone. And I would think for liability reasons alone, there might be something in Woebot to address that, although I have not looked to see what it is. But this question of the judgment is really interesting. We saw it with Eliza. I think people unburden themselves to their cats for the same reason. The cat is not judging, might think that it's indifferent, but it's not judging. And is this because we haven't yet been let down by robots, by chatbots, or is there something more?
I think it's just kind of connecting or clicking in place with some already existing psychological makeup to our minds. It's something that it fits into the patterns of humans' ways of thinking and feeling, and that makes it feel natural. So it's a difficult thing to say how this is all going to play out eventually, but I think people have resources, and I think that we have ways of dealing with it, and that we can start to think of things in a more sophisticated way once we have access to these robots and we have regular interaction with them, and we're actually farther down this road. It's kind of like in the 1990s when the internet actually came online. There were people saying, what do we need this for? I mean, what does it do? You know, I don't see the point. And we couldn't have envisioned at that time the incredible profusion of like interests and activities and services and things that we can do through the internet that have transformed our lives. And I think the same thing is going to be the case for robots. Hmm. You know, we can't really envision. I think new subcultures will be invented. I think that people who have common interests that they can share with robots and with a group of people online at the same time that's heavily informed by robots. I mean, say you have people like who are into dress rehearsals, games where they wear costumes and interact and all this stuff. You know, I mean, you know, there will be people who will really get into doing that sort of thing. That's just off the top of my head. And then there's transsexuals, which is already a thing. But to try to go beyond that is very difficult because we don't really know. We don't have enough information to know. But we do have enough information to know that the effect is going to be very profound on human culture and on human society. And we know that because of what we know about ourselves.
Hmm. It's interesting to contemplate whether we know more about the robots than ourselves at this point. And you used the term digital enmeshment earlier, which I really liked, and we're obviously talking about aspects of that. Do you have a handy definition of digital enmeshment and what that covers?
Well, what it covers is just this whole kind of electronic cocoon that we live in that consists of wireless signals and multiple devices. It's something that includes, you know, our culture that has become a staple in our culture now. I mean, you almost have to live that way in order to flourish and function as a human being in Western society, at least. You've got to have a cell phone. You've got to have a computer. And people are really trained on all this digital culture that comes from videos and social media. We're immersed in it more than ever. Younger people are totally immersed in it. They're growing up in it. And I think they eventually will have a more sophisticated understanding and way of dealing with these things because they're so familiar and they're so steeped in it. Hmm. And we can't really predict how that's going to go either, but I do have some optimism about the younger generations. And I think that people have resources and that we can learn to harness all this in a way that really helps us flourish as human beings, as long as we're aware and just skeptical enough to say we can anticipate what some of the problems might be. So let's try to talk about them now. Let's try to address them now. Mm. We have resources. So I'm pretty much an optimist in terms of all of this. I'm an optimist in general, but I do think that human beings, when in the last analysis, we'll get a handle on this. We'll learn to master it.
And I'm just fascinated by the ways in which we empathize with robots, even when we know that they're robots. Somehow, in some cases, that uncanny valley where something is close enough to being human to be creepy becomes a canny mountain of some kind. To talk about the therapist bots, like Wobot, which people will unburden themselves to in ways that they won't with humans. That suggests a way that human therapists could use that in an adjunct to do things faster than they would accomplish themselves. And it's really interesting to me that you can get this benefit from interacting with a robot precisely by knowing that it is a robot and not a human being at that point. It reminds me of the Moxie robot, which you also mentioned. And we had the founder of that company, Paolo Pajanian, on the show a few years ago talking about it. And that's this pint-sized robot that interacts with children with emotional development issues. And parents have reported how that robot enables their child to get to a place of open communication faster than they are able to do themselves. What's the upside here of a PATH? What sort of lines of research are you excited about that are developing positive ways of interacting with robots that could open up positive outcomes for people's growth?
Well, one of them, which is closely related to what you just said, is the use of autism-specific programs in robots meant for the home that actually provide teaching, therapy, and kind of just social interaction 101 with children who have autism. And they've had success with this, and it really has had a measurable effect on some children who started out with very low social skills and got up to a certain point. I say a certain point because it won't take you all the way to where you need to be a social butterfly or anything, but it will take you up to a certain point after which you need to transfer those skills into the human arena, which is the challenging arena that we all have to learn to deal with in our life in order to be effective, and to take those skills and take those into the human arena and have a head start, or at least have a level playing field between people who started out with autism and people who've been able to get better. So I think that's an exciting and a helpful use of it. Another use of robots that I see as being really super positive is in the area of home caregiving robots. That's an area that already we have some robots. You're probably familiar with some of the animal robots that are used in nursing homes to provide comfort and certain level of therapy, kind of almost like a therapy animal for people with dementia. But you also have robots in the home that can do things like lift a disabled person, lift them from the bed and put them into a wheelchair and back again, that can help them bathe, that can help them dress, and of course, do all those little things that are so important when you come down to it, like turn off the lights, adjust the thermostat. For a person who's immobile, bring me a glass of milk. I think there's a bright spot right there for caregiving. I think the danger, this is the thing that concerns me a little bit about that, is that some people might actually end up outsourcing the care of their loved ones to an extent that is not good and is not healthy and doesn't maintain a proper relationship. So I don't know. That's another road that we're building as we're driving on it in learning how this is going to play out when these things become widespread. But I think they will become widespread.
Right. Do you know if those robots that have the ability to help people get in and out of bed, take baths, if they're out of the research labs yet? I imagine that there are people that would ask where to put their money down.
There are some. And one of them that stands out in my mind also, that's a robot that is not a personal robot that's very effective, is a bed that splits into two and one half of it turns into a wheelchair. And then when you're done doing being mobile and doing what you need to do, you can tell it to take you back and it'll dock with the bed again and turn back into a bed. So, I mean, there's different pieces of this are being developed in different labs for different applications. And I don't think it's come together in a highly enabled, effective caregiving robot for the home right now. The things that are available for the home right now are robots that specialize in companionship and entertainment and things along those lines, which not to dismiss them, because I think they can serve a purpose too, and they can also be very seductive.
Are you aware of research that establishes at what point we start relating to the robot as some kind of entity, some sort of surrogate consciousness, as opposed to being a machine. You talk about Roombas and people naming those. Yes, my wife named ours, called it Frank. I think it's short for Frankenstein, not sure. But you mentioned that 43 people dressed their Roombas up as fictional characters and the other things like this. How many times did you find yourself saying, these people need help, or something like that?
I think there were a few occasions when I had to say, surely you can draw the line here. But then again, you don't want to kind of prejudge how you might react to some of these things, because when you combine things like movement, which looks like intelligent movement, with some rudimentary robots that make eye contact, that follow you with their head when you move, and that speak and respond to your language in a more or less appropriate way, it's very compelling. And anthropomorphization is irresistible to the human mind. We've done it since the days we were born. Look at child culture, how much anthropomorphize animals, cars, machines. Then you even see older people, adult people, who give names to their cars, people who give names to their computers. So I just think it's a very natural human tendency. And again, it's like the robotic relationship is clicking into the already moving parts of our brains that are just kind of intrinsic to the whole way that we apprehend the world and the way we function. And that's what makes them really enticing and really kind of seductive when you look at it. I'm not sure how good that we want this to be. I don't know how much we want to be enmeshed with relationships with robots. I think we're always going to be kind of in a tension with trying to get the most out of those robots and not over-rely on them or lose our perspective about them. Well, there will be a tension there.
What do you suppose the evolutionary advantage is to anthropomorphizing so easily?
Oh, I think it's all about trying to predict behavior of others. And when we encounter something like an animal, we have no idea what's going on in the animal's mind, but we can start to kind of infer what we might think it might do. I think it's kind of a protective thing. I think it's in some way fundamentally bound up with the survival complex, the survival instinct.
That's the end of the first half of the interview, because this one ran long enough to be worth splitting into two halves for ease of download and attention spans. It's really interesting how Eve is helping us uncover this phenomenon of enmeshment and how humans become emotionally involved with machines. And it's clear that it's only going to escalate considerably given how more human-like the AIs and robots are becoming. By the way, you can hear me talk about Wobot and Eliza in my 2023 TEDx talk, Empathetic AI, Unlocking Trust Between Humans and Machines. In today's news, ripped from the headlines about AI, the impact of generative AI on jobs continues to get louder. A team including economist Erik Brynjolfsson at the Stanford Digital Economy Lab, in conjunction with MIT, on the use of Gen AI at a call center, found that access to AI assistance increased agent productivity by 14%, with the biggest impact on less experienced workers. Lindsay Raymond, an MIT PhD candidate and co-author, said, quote, "We found that workers with access to AI see fairly significant productivity gains, but most of those gains accrue to novice or less able workers. This may be because the AI model disseminates the potentially tacit knowledge of more able workers and helps new workers move up the experience curve," end quote. They found that the tool allowed agents to resolve 13.8% more issues per hour. Agents were able to move through issues more quickly, handle multiple calls at once, and were more successful at resolving issues. This is in line with other reports that large language models improve worker performance generally, but do the most for the least capable workers. But then there's an article in the Washington Post about the owner of an e-commerce platform in India who fired 27 of his customer service agents and replaced them with a ChatGPT-powered bot named Lena. He said, quote, "It was a no-brainer for me to replace the entire team with a bot which is like 100 times smarter, who is instant, and who cost me like a hundredth of what I used to pay to the support team," end quote. So then there's that. Now, that's not a study. We have no indication of how good the people were at their jobs or how good Lena was. But clearly, we're going to see generative AI used both as an assistant for existing workers and in some sectors, particularly customer service, as a replacement, for good or worse. Next week, we'll conclude the interview with Eve Herold, when we'll talk about how robots and AI can bring out the best and the worst in us, the responsibilities of roboticists, the difference between robots having emotions and our believing that they have emotions, and how this will evolve over the next decade or more. That's next week on AI and You. Until then, remember, no matter how much computers learn how to do, it's how we come together as humans that matters.
That's all for this episode of AI and You. Please leave a rating and comment and share with your friends. Get the book Artificial Intelligence and You and see more videos and articles at aiandyou.net. That's aiandyou.net, where you can also send us your questions. Thank you for listening.